episode of the Access Vikings podcast. My name is Andrew Kramer, joined by Matthew Caller of Purple Insider. Please check out his work at purpleinsider.com and the podcast wherever you get your podcast. Matthew, thank you for joining.
Oh, I am happy to be here inside TCO Performance Center, where we just got done talking with Brian Flores, Josh Metellus, and Harrison Phillips.
We sure did. Late change with, it was supposed to be Byron Murphy, but Josh Metellus came in, always where he's not supposed to be, showing up at any position Josh Metellus does. Anyway, we'll talk about what we heard from Flores, not getting an interview, he said, or even an opportunity to interview, which I thought was the important question, because it gets reported that he doesn't get any interviews, but who knows if he's getting asked to interview and he says, no, it's okay, Washington, for instance, I don't want to go interview with you. But that wasn't the case. Flores said, I asked him, did you get any opportunities? And he said, no. Matt, what did you think about just what he had to say about this? Because this was the first time we talked to him since the end of the season last year. What did you think about what he had to say about that head coaching cycle and just how he envisions this year too moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, there's not a whole lot that he could say. He didn't get any opportunities, and it is what it is. Like, you can't change that. You have no control over it. I did wonder if he would say something to the effect of, it was disappointing, it's frustrating. He did not go down the road when Kevin Seifert asked him about the lawsuit, about whether that was something that was impacting it. But I think we all have this thing called common sense, and we can figure that out, that he got those interviews after the year in Pittsburgh likely to be able to say, hey, we gave him those opportunities after the lawsuit had just come out, and once those headlines died down, he wasn't going to get any other opportunities because the National Football League and its owners sometimes blackball people. And this has been proven before with a particular quarterback, and they were penalized for it, but I'm sure they didn't care about the dollars they had to dole out because they have plenty of dollars. And they probably won't care if they lose the lawsuit to Brian Flores either, because they're not going to make him the face of their franchise. Maybe time will heal all wounds eventually at some point for Brian Flores, but I kind of doubt it after this, after he didn't get a single phone call, and there were lots of other coaches who are less qualified and had less good seasons at their own positions last year. I thought for him to get the defense to where it finished last year was a really incredible feat. But when you look at the roster and also the way that he connected with his players and bonded with his players, there's another thing too about coaches where their first time is not always perfect and then they learn and grow. Bill Belichick is probably the most glaring example of that historically, but there have been plenty of situations where maybe everything wasn't perfect the first time or was contentious the first time with an owner in Miami, and you know, a different situation could be good. It seems to have really gelled flawlessly here with his players. I think it's extremely genuine the way that they talk about working with Brian Flores, how much they respect his knowledge, but also the way that he is bonded with them as well. But I have a tough time thinking that there is ever going to be another opportunity for him, which is a home run for the Minnesota Vikings. I mean, it's just to have a coach of his caliber that usually would get scooped up pretty fast for a head coaching job and be able to build on that year after year with pieces that he has picked as a guy who made his bones in the scouting universe. You just see the looks on Josh Metellus and Harrison Phillips' faces when talking about Brian Flores. They light up. You could tell the excitement for them. And I think Phillips really said it well, that like, it's great that he's got methods for team building and such, but it's the way the guy calls the game. And I totally agree. That's what it comes down to. And to be able to now take the bones of what they did last year and try to improve on that, it's a significant advantage for this defense.
Grand Casino would like to take a moment and salute the true football fan. The passion, the hope, the anticipation, that incomparable feeling of winning. Grand Casino would also like to take a moment to remind you that you can find all that anticipation, thrill, and winning at Grand Casino. Grand Casino, let your story begin.
Yeah, Brian Flores, I mean, there's no questioning his ability to create and be a defensive mind that is at the forefront of these trends and trying to stop these trends. And he talked about the offensive trends that he went back and studied this offseason and the things that they're going to try and get ahead of this year, because he said there were things that obviously bugged us as a defense last year. But you mentioned Harrison Phillips, and the one thing that stood out to what Harrison had to say, and somebody who is a leader on this team and who participated, he talked about participating in some of these leadership Zoom calls that I guess Kevin O'Connell has with some of the select veterans in the offseason. But Harrison Phillips was talking about Flores when somebody asked about him, and he said, you know, I had ideas in my head about what it was going to be like when he first came in, saying he was coming from New England, knowing it was strict there. You know, Harrison didn't want to come out and say those preconceived notions that he had, but you could kind of read between the lines of what he was saying. And it seems to be that he has met players with a genuineness, and I don't want to go as far as to call it compassion, because that's not a word that they've ever used, but it's been at least a approachability and more of a player's mentality than you might have thought of when you heard the stories coming out of Miami, where it was Kenny Stills, it was Tua, offensive guys, albeit, but guys that he wasn't necessarily getting along with in Miami when he was the head coach. So I do think that he seems to have learned some things from how the first one went around. Being with Kevin O'Connell is probably the greatest coach you could pair with in terms of being more personable or coming across as such. So I guess the question is, Matt, is it just a matter of time, you think, with him? And obviously it's a good problem for the Vikings to have, but it seems to be that this guy's eventually going to become talked about in these head coaching cycles. It's just maybe after 1 year was too soon when you've got the lawsuit. And also that defense last year, internally, when we're looking at it, because we are so close to it, it was very impressive what they did with it last year. But it also ended with a lot of losses, and a lot of losses that were on the defense giving up 30 plus points.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that was because they were so paper thin. Yeah. And as soon as they lost one or two players, I mean, they lost their number one corner and their number two defensive end in DJ Wonnum, who had, in my mind, I shouldn't say underrated, because we gave him plenty of coverage, but DJ Wonnum did a lot of things for the defense, and the drop off from him to the next guy to take his spot was so big. Yep. So when they lost their second best defensive lineman along with their number one corner, things really just came apart at the end. But when they had even a remotely healthy defense throughout the season, they pitched a shutout in a game. They were good.
But to be a Dan Quinn retread defensive coach, you got to have a lights out Dallas Cowboys defense that leads you to the postseason. That is like, my point is like, you need to leave no doubt.
Right. So I think what you're saying is, like, if next year they had a top five defense, would Brian Flores get attention? I don't know the answer to that question.
I hope so, wouldn't you?
But the lawsuit is such a big factor, and the owners are such a big factor. Are you going to make someone the front door of your franchise who is suing the National Football League? It's just, I've never believed that it was going to happen. And what this gives an opportunity, though, is I look over at Kansas City and Steve Spagnuolo, who had a shot as a head coach, didn't work out, and has now solidified himself in that position in Kansas City, and took a defense that was pretty miserable when Patrick Mahomes first got there, and has turned it into a defense that didn't get discussed because Mahomes is on the team, but really was a key factor in leading them to the Super Bowl. And when you can have a defensive coordinator year in and year out, we saw this from Mike Zimmer. You can build the talent, but you can also build it the way you want to build it. You can pick out the free agents that you like. And as much as Flores called it collaborative, I don't need it to be. I'm fine with Brian Flores picking out the groceries and having Kwesi Adofo-Mensah go get them, because I understand from seeing him operate last year how good he is at player evaluation. And Josh Metellus has told this story several times, but loves telling it, about how Flores identified him off of only a handful of snaps as having much more capabilities, and then implemented that. And now they have a star in Josh Metellus. When this guy was cut out of his first camp, he was played 200 snaps or something under Ed Donatell. And now you look at him as a centerpiece of this defense. That's Flores's ability to not only identify that, put players in positions to succeed, and now he can add extra layers. And when you have a defensive coordinator for 5 years in a row, which I think they will with Brian Flores, then you can build and build and build and build on that in the same way that Zimmer gets here in 2014. And by 2017, they're the number one defense in the NFL. Ideally, that's what they're trying to do, that next year you'd go into free agency with a huge amount of money and say, all right, we got started last year, but now we're really going to pour in. Next year is the year that you get your Christian Wilkins or whatever other star player that you want to spend an insane amount of money on, because you can, because you have a rookie quarterback contract. I think it's going to work majorly in their favor, but I also feel that no matter what he does next year, they've made that decision already. The 32-31 owners have made the decision already that he's not going to be a head coach again anytime soon, and that is unfortunate, because the way that he was treated in Miami, what he was asked to do in Miami, assuming that there's truth to all rumors there, you can never ask a coach to lose games on purpose. And the fact that that happened, and then with those interviews, token interviews for black coaches who are deserving, it's a major issue. And he may have sacrificed his future as a head coach to shine light on that. And you know what? Some minority coaches got opportunities this year. I don't know if there's a connection there or not, but if there is, then his role in that, you know, might be something that's remembered. But I don't think that anyone's going to say, yeah, he had a top five defense last year, let's throw all that other stuff aside and let's put him back in.
It does make me think of what Matt Daniels, or the Vikings black special teams coordinator, said a year ago when talking about this stuff, and saying that, you know, you do have to tip your cap to people who paved the way. And he didn't say Brian Flores, but he was kind of talking about Brian Flores and saying that there are people who are uncomfortably going to shine light on some of these things. When he was talking about his own head coaching aspirations, speaking of Matt Daniels's. So, yeah, I guess that makes sense. I would be shocked, though, if this is a results-based business, and like the Falcons and Kirk Cousins, it takes one. And it takes one team to get desperate enough to say, you know what, that Vikings defense was, let's say it becomes lights out and continues to ascend the way it does. The conversation is neither here nor there whether he's going to get it, because we're talking about, yeah, a traditionally white, stubborn league that they have all these bonuses for a reason, and the Niners can pick up third-round picks just because their minority front office members are getting hired elsewhere. There's a reason for that. Anyway, though, I do think the one thing that's certain about this defense, Matt, is that they're going to play more man coverage, or want to play more man coverage, in 2024. They signed Shaq Griffin, who Josh Metellus says is good at man matching, which he says, quote, I think most corners should be. I thought that was interesting that he said that. Brian Flores basically said that they are in the market for more corners, which should be obvious enough given their current depth chart. So what do you think about the transition they're trying to make here, where they play so much zone last year, they blitz so much last year because they can't cover for very long? How realistic is this transition they are attempting to make, both with personnel and with the scheme, in terms of more man?
At this moment, I don't have a ton of confidence in it because of the personnel.
Sure.
And what I would say about that is, feel free to prove me wrong, a Caleb Evans and Andrew Booth Jr. Now, if they were to draft 23rd and 11th and take a cornerback, then that confidence might improve. Yeah. Because there are some really good corners in this draft. Kool-Aid McKinstry, Terrion Arnold, you could see these guys, Nate Wiggins, all being available toward the back end of the first round, with so many offensive players going at the top. And if the Vikings say, and I don't think this will happen, but if they draft Michael Penix at 11 and then they're going to 23 and saying, all right, well, a couple DTs and DNs are off the board, what do we need? Look for that lockdown corner, because at this moment they have the farthest from that. I mean, Byron Murphy is, in my mind, a above average nickel corner and a below average outside corner who was forced to outside corner last year just because of the personnel. And he never complained about it. He never said anything that he didn't appreciate the role. But when he came here, he talked about, I'm more comfortable at nickel. That's where I've been better. The data backs that up. He's been more successful at the nickel position. And if they can get him there more often, then I think you can do a lot more in the back end. But Shaq Griffin was let go by his own team in the middle of last season, which, you know, I don't know. People from Houston said, well, it was a numbers thing or whatever. Okay, well, but if he is really successful, then you would have found a way to keep him on the team when it was a playoff team and you would want that depth. he hasn't been great numbers wise in quite a few years. And those are very Dean Lowry sounding things. Oh, you know, a few years ago, he was really good. Oh, okay. 1 year, $6 million doesn't sound like we've got our answer, folks. Right.
It was really 1 year, four and a half.
Okay.
So it's even cheaper.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
So that makes me think that's almost on the borderline of competing for a job in training camp. Now, if Andrew Booth Jr., who was drafted to play a different defense, was drafted for skill set that fit with a different defense, has improved over a year to give them some confidence he can play. Now, we never believe in these things, and we shouldn't, but we have seen players in the past who we went into training camp going, all right, this guy's fourth, fifth, whatever in the depth chart, and it ends up working. And one of those players was even Trey Wayans, where when I think it was going into 2017, we weren't 100% sure Trey Wayans was even the starter. And then he ends up having a very good year in 2017 and being their starter. Sometimes it takes a few years to develop. Sometimes it takes some adaptation. I do think Andrew Booth Jr. is skilled. We've seen that from a little bits and spurts in training camp that he can play man, that he can match up with wide receivers and mirror them. It's his best talent. It's just, can he play with a toughness that Brian Flores is going to want? That we have not really seen. A physicality, which, again, he was drafted to play a different defense that played off coverage and was supposed to mirror at the top of routes. Now you're asking for different types of things. So him, a Caleb Evans, I don't think there's another step there for a Caleb Evans. I thought last year was what he's going to be. So I'm still looking for, if this defense is ever going to be great, it has to find that star corner, not just, well, we've cobbled together a bunch of guys who might be competent.
So it sounds like you're saying their ability to do this is depending on who else they get.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, how Flores is going to play his coverages at this moment, I have no idea. But I just don't see the cornerback group as being anywhere near even average. I think it's a below average group at this moment with no standout player. And until they get that standout player, until they get something that reminds me of Xavier Rhodes, I'm not going to really believe that that's a strength of this defense or that they can be elite. I don't think you can be an elite defense without at least one, but probably two very, very good corners. And right now they have zero.
Yeah, and they're a small cornerback group right now. Caleb Evans is 6'2". Shaq Griffin is, 6'1"? 6', something like that. Like, they're not the biggest group. And so if Mekhi Blackmon, who's 5'10", 5'11", is your next guy on the outside too, you're even smaller with Byron Murphy in the middle. So they clearly want to do this in part because I think Harrison Smith needs to play less. I think they want to play him less. So that means if they do have more two predominantly safety groupings with Metellus and Bynum, you know, Lewis Cine's not even getting talked about still in this picture. We'll see. But he's in the same camp that Booth is and Asamoah is, where it's just like, show me literally anything in terms of the coaching staff and getting those opportunities. And so talking to Booth last year, too, you wonder if the light truly did click on or not, because he just talked about, I'm waiting for my opportunity. Well, that's not a guy who sounds like he's very aware of what he needs to work on. So Evans, I would have to agree with you, somebody who clearly can't make a play on the ball, and they need somebody who can play man-to-man and make plays on the ball. So you do wonder if they're going to be trying to trade back into a round two, a round three pick, if it isn't those two first-round picks acquiring more cornerback talent. And moving on from there, you asked Flores today about Van Ginkel and some of the edge rusher stuff that they've kind of tried to pair together. How do you feel like they're moving on from Daniil Hunter, from Marcus Davenport? Because if they are going to spend the first pick on a quarterback, it's not going to be on Dallas Turner or Jared Verse.
They're moving on from Marcus Davenport. I think Marcus Davenport moved on from them as soon as he got a high ankle sprain, which is normally a 6-week injury that took him out the rest of the season. But best of luck to him in Detroit. We'll see how many snaps he plays. But as far as what they did to replace Daniil Hunter, I would say as best as they could have. I mean, you get a day one free agent in Jonathan Grenard, who I understand has only really had one great season as an edge rusher, and they paid a lot for him. So that comes along with a bit of risk. But also, when you look under a microscope at those stats, I don't think that they were fake. Sorry, DJ Wonnum. We kind of know what fake sack numbers look like, which is Justin Fields lets you sack him four times, and that's half your production for the season. I don't think that was Jonathan Grenard. I also don't think he's Myles Garrett. He is a guy that is going to need some other people around him. Will Anderson on the other side in Houston was clearly an advantage for Jonathan Grenard. He may get more attention this time. But also, Brian Flores' defense is drawn up to not allow anyone to just focus too much on one guy. They were able to do it to some extent to Danielle Hunter last year, doubling him up and so forth. But his whole idea is to not know where the rush is coming from, who's lining up where, and it makes preparation very difficult on the offensive line. And he even talked about going to the offensive line coach, Chris Cooper, and showing him some stuff. Hey, would this be a pain in the ass for you? You know, and asking them that question. And that's Brian Flores' mind. Van Ginkel is a very important piece of this to me because he is such a unique player. There are very few players in the NFL who can cover, who can sack the quarterback, who create pressure, who line up off the ball, who line up middle linebacker. He did it all for Flores in Miami and then did it even after Flores left in Miami. And I just think he was such a valuable piece and a legitimate playmaker. So I don't look at him as exactly the opposite side of Grenard because he's going to be everywhere. So then I'm curious of how they're going to work that out. Are they going to have three defensive tackles at times? Are they going to have Jerry Tillery, who they signed in there, along with Bullard and Phillips? I mean, it all says work in progress to me. And the guys that they signed multi-year deals, and probably for a reason. They wanted not just space fillers, but, you know, Blake Cashman, you're here for a couple years. Van Ginkel, you're here for a couple years. Grenard, you're here on a long-term contract, because I don't think that these problems can completely be solved this offseason, and they weren't. So there's still holes there and there's still questions there. But I think they did enough to create a legitimate pass rush with the players that they have. And just how defense works in general, it's better to have two guys than one, even if the one guy was Danielle Hunter. The two guys who are real good at their jobs probably make more of an impact than one guy who's great at his job. And as great as Hunter was, they didn't have great defenses recently, even when he had great seasons himself individually, because defense is often a product of where your weaknesses are. So I think they shored up a lot of their weaknesses, but they still exist. There was just nothing you could do in one offseason to say, all right, we've solved everything that was a gaping hole from last year.
Yeah, it feels a lot to me like a lateral move a little bit, maybe even a step down in talent. Because if Danielle Hunter and Marcus Davenport play 17 games for you, that's probably a more talented duo than Grenard and Van Ginkel. But Grenard and Van Ginkel offer a versatility that I don't think the other two necessarily do. When you talk about Van Ginkel's role, hey, he can play off-ball linebacker. He did that under Flores. Vic Fangio tried to get him to do that before moving him back to the edge because of injuries there in Miami. So he's got enough versatility that they're going to do that shape-shifting stuff where it's always something different, and Ivan Pace will be rushing the passer in a play where Harrison Phillips is dropping into a zone or something like that. The thing that I wonder most about this defense is you hear their name tied to Christian Wilkins, but there was no way they were coming close to that $27 million or whatever that he got from Las Vegas. If Harrison Phillips is talking about playing less and coaches wanting him to play less, how is that happening? Because who are they going to get on the interior of this defense when we're talking about them needing to draft a corner when free agency is over? They obviously moved on from Dean Lowry, but the interior of that group to me is where you have to wonder, or where I think they're going to have to continue to piece things together too, even more. And if Brian Flores is in any kind of talks for head coaching circles in 2025, he's certainly going to be earning it with, I think, this personnel.
The interior of the defensive line is still a huge problem.
Yeah.
And that's where another thing would be if they stayed at 23 or even 11, but I don't think they're drafting their quarterback at 23. But let's just say getting someone like the other Byron Murphy, the draftable Byron Murphy, or Johnny Newton from Illinois, if they were able to come out of the draft with one of those guys, that's usually the only place you can ever get a defensive tackle. Christian Wilkins was kind of rare to be available. They just don't come available that often. DeForest Buckner a few years back, but it's not like every year you could go into free agency and just say, oh, well, there's some superstar defensive tackle. I almost think, maybe it's a hot take, that defensive tackle, an impact defensive tackle, is the hardest player to find in the NFL. And that's even more so than quarterback. How many true impact defensive tackles. I mean, you go into the game and go, this guy is going to give us major problems. How many are in the league? There might be 7 or 8.
Probably the same amount of quarterbacks. Yeah, so that few.
Except for with quarterbacks, if you put enough around them, you can make the 15th best quarterback a Super Bowl quarterback. Where defensive tackle, there's no pumping up the value. There's no, hey, we'll just put this guy near him and he'll be better. And I mean, just off the top of my head, I can come up with less than 10 who you go into a game and go, oh man, Kenny Clark, DeForest Buckner,
Dexter Lawrence,
these guys are going to probably wreck you every single game. And the defenses that have them, it's such a cheat code. And everybody else is scrambling. And getting Jonah Williams, the other one, and Jerry Tillery, this is scrambling. This is just, this is me hitting it in the woods and trying to like hack it back onto the fairway. Let's just get a 5 on this hole. We're going to just try to like keep it in play and not have it be, and bringing back, you know, Jonathan Bullard, not have it be kind of a wreck like it was last year, where you're playing 2 run stuffing rotational players, like 800 snaps. That just can't be the case. But usually, if you're going to get someone who's one of those elite players, somebody had a chart on this that showed all the highest paid defensive tackles. They're all first round picks, almost all of them. Chris Jones, I think, was a 2nd. You usually have to spend a high draft pick to get them because teams don't give them away, and you can't draft and develop somebody because it's so based on freakish skill. This might be a reason to not want to give up the 2025 first round pick, or a reason to want to try to stay and pick at 11 and 23 if they can. Until then, you're just kind of hoping and praying that it's good enough. But it's not going to. This is why you can't be an elite defense. You can be a good defense, but you cannot be a top 5 defense if you have no game-changing defensive tackle and no shutdown corner.
Yeah, if you don't have studs at every level of the defense, which the Vikings just can't do. You can't, as you said, you can't do in one off season, can't do in 2 off seasons. Really, it takes years of hitting on these picks. And when you're talking about the defensive tackles, yeah, you can't produce an Aaron Donald by just, you know, scheming some things up around those guys. It is going to be fascinating to see how the Vikings turn that around, because it's horrific right now for them. Let's talk about the
Sorry, Jerry Tillery. We haven't even met you yet, and you're calling him horrific.
It's not a great outlook.
It's not. I mean, if we were ranking all the interiors of the defensive and the offensive line, this team does not rank very high.
They do not. And losing Jordan Hicks, I think, is going to be an underrated one. I know you talk about Grenard having one season breakout with Houston. Well, Cashman only had 1-2 in Houston to earn this contract, and good for him. But he got just barely over, I think, essentially what Jordan Hicks got at 31 years old in Cleveland in terms of contract value. So the Vikings were absolutely going for kind of a budget younger replacement, and somebody who has been good in pass coverage, Cashman has been, but I just wonder how their run defense is going to pair together, and we have 4 or 5 whole months to wonder that. Speaking of, though, Matt, we only have 1 week to talk about this quarterback situation on Thursday night.
I haven't thought about it.
You haven't thought of it? You haven't talked about it for months, right?
No, I haven't. I haven't even considered what might happen. So maybe you should give me some options and I can decide what I think.
You know, Chili's is not a sponsor of this podcast, but they're unfortunately not going to get the Vikings business anymore because Kirk Cousins will not be holding the weekly Chili's meetings that Harrison Phillips said he used to with the team. But what did you think of what Kevin O'Connell had to say in his last availability before they make the big potential big jump up for a quarterback?
I don't think that O'Connell has shown many of his cards. The one thing he keeps coming back to is talking about processing, which he defined, thankfully, since we hear it constantly from draft analysts and it just sounds like some nebulous thing that they made up. And I see in every draft report that the rookie quarterback can't get to his 4th read or something. And you're like, okay, well, I don't know how many college quarterbacks even have 4th reads, but sure, fine, I guess so. It's really his goal, though, to be able to discover and determine through this process of this journey, if you will, of meeting with all these quarterbacks, which ones can process his offense. Because what we found out last year, and I don't dock him for this because Josh Dobbs is not good and Nick Mullins was able to throw it where it was supposed to go. He just didn't throw it there all that well. But we did discover that if you're thinking Kevin O'Connell was going to take his offense in the middle of a season and do what they did that one time with Tim Tebow and just change it all around and make it this running quarterback offense, run first and play action or something for Dobbs. That was never going to happen. That Chicago game was very instructive, where they were running successfully and threw 35 times and ran 16. This is a offense that is on the shoulders of the quarterback, period. Aaron Jones is a wonderful player. This offense is on the quarterback. And this is why I think that it's important that Sam Darnold is here. And I saw some criticism for paying him $10 million. It might be $10 million well spent. If he is the quarterback, well, somebody else who's the rookie sits and learns how to operate this thing, because there are probably some offenses that can simplify and run first, and that's how it's going to be. This is not one of them.
This is why they wanted Kirk back.
Yes, 100%. This is why Kevin O'Connell, I think, was a little distraught when Kirk decided to pick Atlanta, because he knew this is going to be a long road. It took 2 years for Kirk, a veteran who has as high a football IQ as any person you'll ever meet in your life, and it took him a year and a half to really truly look like he was fully comfortable in this. Now, when you get there, when you reach heaven, it was really something. It was really something. With the way they were playing against San Francisco and Green Bay, he was throwing with anticipation. He was making every read, picking up every blitz, and that was what O'Connell talked about when he said he was playing the best football of his career. It wasn't true. He had played better in the past, but not that complicated, and yet operating it like that with such comfort. And if it takes a year and a half for a rookie and you're halfway through 2025 when it clicks and the guy becomes great, well, wonderful. That's what you're looking for. It's just so important that whoever they get can comprehend it all, can communicate with O'Connell, can say when he's not getting it, and not just be like, okay, coach, I got it, because then he's going to go out there and not get it. Like, this fit can be a cheat code, or it can be a total detriment to the player that they get based on O'Connell. And I'm comfortable with that. I mean, I think that there is plenty of coaches in the past. I kind of think of him Bruce Arians-like in some ways, where wants to push the ball down the field, he wants to pass all the time, and he's going to ask a ton of his quarterback. You can certainly win that way. It's just, it's not going to be San Francisco, where you can get a seventh rounder and he can just kind of get it to the right places.
Well,
or something.
No, San Francisco puts a lot on the quarterback too. And I mean, they had to adjust things for Brock Purdy when he got into the game, or the season that 1 year he got in 2 years ago. But San Francisco is an incredibly complicated offense, where they do it though. They can lean on the running game, because that is truly part of their complications, is the running game and how diversified that is, in a way that the Vikings cannot master in any way under O'Connell, at least for 2 years.
Well, we also saw Nick Mullins average like 9 yards an attempt for San Francisco. I mean, when I totally get what you're saying.
Maybe they have a way to mold it and adjust it to different quarterbacks in a way that O'Connell has not figured out.
I think that the difference is that San Francisco has a lot of people running over the middle of the field. And if you can find them, you can succeed. Whereas O'Connell likes to push it vertically, so it's double moves and it's anticipation throws. And this is why, and I may end up looking totally foolish with this take, because that's the draft and no teams ever tell anybody who they're picking, despite what insiders claim. I just look at Michael Penix and go, is that not a guy who makes a lot of sense for this thing? I know they want to trade up. They want to get Drake May. Everyone in the world thinks they want McCarthy. That might be true, because McCarthy's mental capacity is supposed to be very high. But you need somebody like that who's going to stand in the shotgun and throw the ball 600 times. And he was that guy in college. So I don't know.
I always find it interesting when people compare him to Sam Bradford. You know, the injury history, I think, is an easy kind of through line for the two of them. But the arm talent, and where they can throw the ball is interesting. You just wonder that they talk so much, and we've heard O'Connell talk about this, Kwesi talk about it. When they list what they want in a quarterback, processing and accuracy are like the two first words out of their mouths regardless. But then the next one is creating off schedule and overcoming, was the word Kwesi used, overcoming a dirty pocket, I think was the direct quote. They want somebody who can, as Kwesi once said when he first got hired, how many people can you save in our building with one play? Like, I think you had asked him at the combine right after he got hired about positional value and how do you judge the different positions. And he said, I judge it based on how many people in our building can that one position save on a given play? And obviously quarterback is the one that can save everybody. And how do you do it? By creating outside of structure and outside of the processing and the accuracy and the rhythm of the play and all the things that coaches love. It's being that playmaker, being that dude. And you just wonder if Penix is the guy who can still do that after what he's been through physically. And then in that same vein, is J.J. McCarthy somebody who's physically even built to do that at the NFL level, where he might not be the biggest guy in his own huddle?
And they may really not like how Penix reacted to some dirty pockets, sure, which was not always the best. And we saw that in the Michigan game, although Michigan was twice as good as Washington as a football team. So that's, it's hard when they played against their similar competition in Texas. He crushed them, and he also made plays out off schedule and ran. And then he goes to his pro day and runs a 4.5, and you go, wait, so is the reason that he never did this because he was coached not to do this, or was it because he couldn't do it? And that is a hard thing, because CJ Stroud, go look at every single scouting report on CJ Stroud. Well, the guy's not a playmaker. He can't make plays with his legs, and he, you know, is just going to be an on schedule player. And then he wasn't. And then he made crazy throws that were off schedule and stuff. You go, oh, that was just how they wanted him to play. This is a different version of the same question with J.J. McCarthy. Is they asked him to play this low usage, hand the ball off, under center, play action, roll out. And every once in a while, it's third and eight, and you need a completion from him. And his numbers are very good in those situations. But we're talking about a handful of snaps. Okay, he's got great numbers on third down and long or something. Like, okay, we're going to chop these numbers down and down and down and down, right? But you could also see O'Connell and him really... He seems like an all football type of guy, really vibing in that way. And Josh McCown involved in this as well, and improving on some of the things that caused his passes outside the numbers to flutter, his deep balls to not look very good, and so forth, and see him as a development part. But the most important is those two things, which is, can he throw it to the right place? And then can he make a play when something goes wrong? And we know, they don't have to tell us. Fourth and eight sticks in everybody. I know Kirk would argue all day long he made the right play, but the reality with that fourth and eight is it wasn't just about him not taking the shot. It was also about he can't run away. And when Dexter Lawrence breaks through the line, J.J. McCarthy could run away. Penix is fast enough to run away. Would he actually do it, or would he check down too? I don't know. Or would he take a shot because he is an aggressive downfield thrower? But that singular play, I think, has influenced even them in making sure that they get that guy. It's just hard for me to figure out, is Penix going to be able to do that and just didn't? And then with McCarthy, is he going to be able to master some of these throwing, you know, techniques to improve on that? Or is it going to be a little wild all the time with him, like it was when he was at Michigan? Nobody's perfect. Even Drake May does crazy stuff on tape. That's why they're college quarterbacks. I mean, usually quarterbacks hit their peak at what, 26, 27, 28. So when you're so far away from that, how do you figure out what problems these guys can solve in an NFL environment?
Yeah, about May, I remember Daniel Jeremiah on one of his conference calls was telling reporters that his offense was such where it didn't look like he had answers against pressures, and he had so much unchecked pressure. It's like, but how much of that is on the offense and his tools at his disposal? And that's what he can answer to O'Connell in their formal, you know, suite at Lucas Oil Stadium at the Combine when they're going through these things on the board. And I thought it was interesting that O'Connell talked about the process of meeting these guys multiple times, whether it was some of the upperclassmen at the Senior Bowl, into the Combine, into the pro days, into the private workouts, about how different he structured those things and what he could get out of it. And I think he'd mentioned figuring out how each of these guys learn. You know, they talked about the leadership stuff too, but what we're talking about as far as the learning and how that's going to be so important, that might be the most crucial aspect to all this. As you talk about the Vikings offense, is they want to get a guy who's got natural talent, but it's just going to come down to the brain and whether or not you can hit on a guy who fits, as you talk about, what you want to do on offense. Is because you got Justin Jefferson watching, you got TJ Hockenson watching, you got a lot of guys who have a lot of money at stake watching.
Isn't it funny about how this quarterback class, and this is why I'm sure they made the decisions that they made, is you can make any one of these guys fit with this team, including Bo Nix, who has been treated as total dog meat despite throwing 45 touchdowns, three picks, and bringing together the raw talent that all the scouting community told us was there.
Yeah.
And then now he's talked about as a nobody. I can't figure out anything when it comes to whose opinions I'm supposed to trust with the draft class, because when he was at Auburn, it was, oh, this guy's going to be a future first-round pick because of his raw talent. And then he puts it all together, puts up huge numbers, and don't worry about him. He means nothing. It's this other guy who's never done anything yet. Now he's the one you should love. Like, what? I don't know. It's very confusing. But the one thing I noticed with Bo Nix most, and you can pick apart the mistakes they make because they're young quarterbacks. Also, pro quarterbacks make mistakes. Did we ever see Kirk Cousins make a mistake? Oh, I don't know. A lot of times throughout the years, but Nick's got the ball out super fast. And I know all the screen pass people who lose their minds. 70% of his passes were not behind the line of scrimmage. And on those throws, even when he was throwing 20 plus yards down the field, PFF has this stat, it was 3 seconds or less. He was dropping back, hitting his spot, and letting that ball go, which may be attractive to Kevin O'Connell. And he does have the athleticism to run as well. Every one of these quarterbacks, you can talk yourself into saying, you know what, I could see it. The one that's hardest, and it may end up being the right answer, I don't know, is Jaden Daniels, because he doesn't really play on rhythm in the same way. Most of his passing yards were on deep shots, which is what percentage in the NFL? Less than 10%, I think, go 20 yards or more. Most of it's intermediate for passing games that crush. And he wasn't a great rhythm passer in college again. But then again, he's got this dynamic running element to him that could raise the floor to, even at worst, you can win a lot of games with him, even if he's a flawed player. So there's none of the – every single one of the guys who are in this top six quarterbacks, I would be completely comfortable with as the Minnesota Vikings' next quarterback. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, Jaden Daniels, I think, is incredibly interesting, but it seems like it's going to be a moot point because he would be the number two overall pick, presumably, to Washington. But I think if you just look at the four, from May to Penix to Nix to McCarthy, this is such a talked about class. You wonder, is this truly like 2020? Is this actually going to be like when it was Tua, Herbert, Jalen Hurts falling to the second round and being somebody nobody talked about, but then being dynamic and leading a team to a Super Bowl? Is this like that class, or is this like, I don't want to rag on Sam Darnold, but is this more like that class where you're going to have a Josh Rosen, you're going to have a Baker Mayfield? It's just not going to be, it's just going to be talked about this way because there's so many options. It makes them seem all great, even though they're all going to be journeyman level. That's the part to me where, because we talk so long and ad nauseum about how this is an inexact science and we have no idea and the teams have no idea. I think there are three of these guys who are talked about and have been talked about for a long time as having different level talent. And I think May, Daniels, and Williams are obviously those guys. I think those other three guys have been talked into the conversation as people who can be NFL starters. But does that mean they're any better than a Dak Prescott? Does that mean they're any better than a Brock Purdy even? You know what I mean? At commanding everything. So it's just so nuanced that I have no idea. I think the Vikings are going to get one of those six guys, and I think they have just as good of a chance as anybody at making that guy into an NFL quarterback because of the setting that they've got, because of the coaching that they've got. This is as good of a setup as probably any that a guy's going to walk into, like a C.J. Stroud into the Houston Texans. It's just a matter of, do they get their C.J. Stroud? Do they get the guy who's capable of walking in and doing those things the way C.J. did? Because you can end up with a Bryce Young who clearly was not set up to overcome everything around him in a way that C.J. had to overcome some things, and he did, even though he had a better setup around him. So I think the Vikings have everything. It's just going to be a matter of, can it fall their way to get the right fit? And then that guy could probably take off.
There's really no overstating that you have the best wide receiver in the National Football League here. A guy who, with Nick Mullins in charge, put up two of the best games of his career on throws that were not accurate most of the time, and yet found a way. And I have no doubt that if Nick Mullins had led him even a little bit against Detroit, they win that game and they might be in the playoffs instead with Nick Mullins as their quarterback. That's how good Justin Jefferson is. And when you can take any of these guys if you are even, think about Carson Wentz, where Carson Wentz had that great team in 2017. He was an MVP caliber player until he got hurt that season. In the long run, we found out Carson Wentz wasn't that good. But you don't need to be perfect, including like Jalen Hurts isn't perfect and Brock Purdy isn't perfect. If you have the right situation around you, your hit rate just goes up. Now, it's not perfect because we saw Trey Lance fail, and that's why we talk about, can you get the ball to the right place and then occasionally do something special? But even when we talk about Mahomes or Allen, the greatness, the true greatness in this league, what percentage of their throws are just on time, in rhythm, throw to the right place? 70%? It's still, even the highest level of greatest quarterback still has to have that as their main central thing. So if you can operate on time and get the ball in Justin Jefferson's area code, you have a chance to be a pretty successful quarterback here. It's why, even though I don't think Sam Darnold is good, I think he could have some really good games here. I think he could play better than anywhere he's ever played, and not even close for a season if they have to end up doing that. It's just a really favorable situation. So that makes it easier to talk yourself into the any of these quarterbacks. Penix stands out to me, though, as being like slightly different than, I agree with you that the top three all have that Mahomes, Allen sort of freako kind of element to them. But at the end of the day, with the quarterback position, throwing the ball is number one, and it still is. And Jared Goff probably didn't run for 6 yards last year and had his team in the NFC Championship, because pocket passing is always still going to be at the top of the list for what's required. And so we can make a lot out of the scrambling, the running, and all that sort of stuff. But if he was playing a Jared Goff-like role, and it's not perfect, and sometimes it's ugly and whatever else, but the guy can really sling it, that I think also is something that he has as a cheat code, where he throws the football. Like, let's not get lost in the forest here with the trees. The guy throws the football better than anybody else, except for probably Caleb Williams. And that, to me, has made me lean a little in that direction, a little more than I think the outside world that wants McCarthy. But if they get McCarthy and develop him for a year, I think he could be a very good quarterback here.
It'll be fascinating if on draft night the Vikings watch the top three quarterbacks go, watch somebody trade up like the Broncos for McCarthy, and just sit back and wait and wait and wait, and then get somebody like Michael Penix or Bo Nix as the Vikings nation sweats out an entire draft cycle.
I've been trying to figure out how Vikings fans are going to perceive this, because every Vikings fan I've ever met told me that they knew Christian Ponder was going to be a bust. Now, that's funny, because I'd like to see the list of other people you thought were going to succeed or bust. It was just as likely that Christian Ponder could have succeeded than he was a bust. It just turned out that way, and Mike Mayock said on TV that they reached. So once that happened, everyone thought, yeah, they reached. They must have done it wrong. I wonder if it will be the same thing with this if they don't pick one of those four guys. If they pick Michael Penix and he's QB5, even if he's the 11th overall pick, if there will be a, oh, well, they couldn't pull off the big trade, so they blew it.
Oh, my God, didn't get the be.
Yeah. Well, I would just advise against it, because when you go through recent history and look at where the best quarterback was from, Lamar Jackson's QB5, right? And so there's a lot of examples of this where it's, I mean, Josh Allen is taken after Sam Darnold and Patrick Mahomes after Trubisky, and those aren't close. Those are complete bust versus legend. So I wouldn't say, oh, well, you got the fifth quarterback. So I think the odds are fairly close with everyone except Caleb Williams, who has really good odds to succeed. But from 2 through 5, it's probably about the same.
You know that's how it's going to happen, though. If they land the trade up to number 3 and get Drake May, it's going to be lauded as the move of all moves. They have their next Josh Allen. This is what they need. If they trade up to whatever, number 4, and get J.J. McCarthy, it's going to be judged solely based on draft position. It's going to be judged. If it's number 3, home run. Number 4, you know what? You did the next best thing. If you wait till number 11, it's going to be judged as, you know what? They just couldn't make that move. And you know what? It's kind of tepid. I don't know what's going on over there in Minnesota.
There will be a, you overpaid for McCarthy, though, I bet. Don't you think?
Like, oh, there's sure. There'll be a faction. Yeah, there'll be a faction of that. But yep. I'm saying that if they trade up, it's going to initially ignite the hope of everybody because it's, oh, they made the move to go get their guy, whether it's Bay, whether it's McCarthy. If they sit back or they trade back and take a guy, that is going to obviously be criticized and questioned as, well, do you know what you're doing? Is that really the guy? The same way that with Lamar Jackson in Baltimore, initially it was, well, what are you doing with your offense? You have Joe Flacco. This doesn't fit what you're doing. And John Harbaugh to come out and say, no, trust us. We're going to build around this guy. Patience is going to be required if the Vikings are patient on draft night.
Well, I was just thinking that about how we have created a very impatient football fan universe because they have a lot of information, which is awesome that every day you can read a new mock draft, a new draft analyst and so forth. And there's all this content out there. They could read about the salary cap. The comp pick experts maybe just need to take a deep breath a little bit. I think that's where you need to question some life choices is when you are
void year people
deeply concerned about comp picks. But, you know, it's just because none of us know they announce it. So why don't we just wait? But that's the thing is that we have so much information that everyone can form an opinion. So when you get to draft night, if it goes against what your opinion was, there's going to be a natural, oh, they did the wrong thing. They pushed the wrong button. But we really won't know with this player for a very long time whether it was the right decision or not. And history tells us that you really don't know for several years, and you definitely don't know on draft night, and that the league is not particularly good at this. They're usually good at picking out who the first round quarterbacks are, but beyond that, which ones are going to succeed or fail, that's always the frustrating thing is we want to have takes on it, and no one's going to put me on TV saying, well, I don't know. Let's go live to Matt down here at ESPN, we'll see. And what do you think? Well, I mean, any of them could succeed. And you're fired and back to Mel Kiper. Like, they just, you know, they
give us the takes. We need the takes.
Right. So I would say this, that it's super fun to have takes. Let's all form them. Let's all make them as hot as possible. But then on draft night, we're going to have to go, they probably put a lot more work into this than we did. So let's see if they get it right or not. Yeah, I'm just going to guess a tad more. And usually that goes against our mentality is to say, you know, the football guys probably have this figured out, so let's just kind of roll with it. We're more of second guessers by nature.
Yeah, we will be with you guys on draft night next week on Thursday night to discuss either praise up or cut down 2 years worth of work in a matter of minutes.
Wow.
Thank you for being on, Matt. Appreciate it.
Anytime.
We will talk to you guys next time. Please check out all of our work at StarTribune.com, and please follow Matt's work on Twitter and at PurpleInsider.com.